The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Early Christianity was, economically speaking, a reaction of Jewish laborers against the wealthy commercial classes. Even after the fall of the Roman Empire, the ruling class still needed luxury goods, and Jews fulfilled this role of trade between the cities. They didn't invest in production, as this was still a pre-capitalist period. So Jewish persecution really only becomes serious around the 12th century with the growth of cities, and with them a native commercial and industrial class. The competition between the native industrial class and the Jews pushes the Jews out of trade, but they still fulfill the role of money lending. The local ruling classes wouldn't do that because Christianity prohibits usury against charging interest on loans. So money lending doesn't create surplus value. It just takes a chunk of the surplus value that's already produced. So people persecuted the Jews because they owed them debts that they didn't want to repay or couldn't repay. And this is sort of understandable, but it's not exactly class consciousness. So in the late 19th and early 20th century, socialists called anti-Semitism the socialism of fools, as people would direct their anger at Jews because they associated them with capitalism instead of directing their anger toward the bourgeoisie. Once Jews were pushed out of trade in Western Europe, many left for Eastern Europe or Turkey, where capitalism hadn't yet penetrated as strongly, and so they still had an economic role to play there. Others assimilated and converted. Soon enough, capitalism caught up in the East, and Jews started moving to other professions or emigrating back to Western Europe or to North America. Machines replaced Jewish artisans, and Jews ended up in competition with peasants arriving to the cities. In 1929, the global economy went into crisis, and this made Jewish emigration intolerable to Western countries. The petty bourgeoisie and even some workers saw the problem as like a Jewish capitalism. And here's where we start to see the rise of fascist anti-Semitism in Germany. So Leon's conclusion is that there is no solution to the Jewish question under capitalism, just as there is no solution to the other problems posed before humanity without profound social upheavals. Now that we have a clear understanding of where anti-Semitism comes from, this history of the Jews occupying an economic role as merchants and moneylenders, we want to look at why Zionism is not a solution to anti-Semitism. Zionism uses the Old Testament and Jewish tradition as a source of inspiration, so we should take a minute to look at a little bit of that Jewish tradition. There's basically an understanding that there will be a messianic end of days, and at that time, Jews will return to Zion. And this is supposed to be divine intervention, not a political orientation. Traditionally, messianism is rejected by Orthodoxy, and messianists are labeled heretics. So what changed? The poverty and persecution of Jews in Eastern Europe drove Jews toward mysticism and messianism. Religion is, after all, a reflection of social interests. So even though Judaism used to say, no return to Zion until the Messiah, now there's a real need to leave Europe, so doctrine starts to bend. In the late 19th and early 20th century, amid pogroms in Russia and later developing fascism in Germany, the project of getting all the Jews out of Europe and into some other place really starts to sound like an important idea. At first, there's talk of setting up a Jewish colony in perhaps Uganda, Madagascar, Argentina. There's a long list of places that were sort of thrown around for that colony. Palestine happens to have good propaganda value because some Jews can trace their ancestry to that land and because of the religious yearning for Zion. But it's really just a colonial project like it would be to bring Jews to any other location. We can have some sympathy that there were some well-intentioned and scared Jews who were looking for some kind of solution short of socialist revolution, which may have seemed impossible, especially after the defeat of the wave of revolutions across Europe in the 1920s. I would argue, though, that the leaders of the Zionist movement were not actually so well-intentioned. So, for example, The founder of political Zionism, Theodor Herzl, wrote in his diary in 1895, quote, "When we occupy the land, we shall bring immediate benefits to the state that receives us. We must expropriate gently the private property on the estate assigned to us. We shall try to spirit the penniless population across the border by procuring employment for it in the transit country while denying it any employment in our own country. The property owners will come over to our side. Both the process of expropriation and the removal of the poor must be carried out discreetly and circumspectly." So he's justifying here that ethnic cleansing, what he calls removal, of Palestinians on the racist basis of claiming that colonization would have a civilizing effect. Menachem Mussiskin, chairman of the Jewish National Fund and a member of the Jewish Agency, of the executive of the Jewish Agency, said in a 1930 speech to journalists, quote, "We must continually raise the demand that our land be returned to our possession. If there are other inhabitants there, they must be transferred to some other place. We must take over the land. We have a greater and nobler ideal than preserving several hundred thousands of Arab Fellahin peasant farmers." So it's a pretty clear case for arguing that these leaders are interested in a colonial project that's not just finding somewhere safe for Jews to live. We also have to make the case that the so-called Zionist left shared in this colonial vision. You've probably heard the myth that early Zionists lived on utopian kibbutzim, which is the plural for kibbutz, which were basically these socialist microcosms. But in reality, this so-called socialism is really an exclusivist Jewish collectivism, and it was necessary for the nature of the colonial settler project. When Jewish immigrants arrived to Palestine from Europe, they expected a certain living standard and couldn't compete with Arabs selling their labor. The Histadrut, the Jewish labor union, first and foremost, had to figure out how to help Jewish immigrants make a living without being undercut by cheaper Arab labor. They advocated for Jewish labor and organized boycotts of Arab products. In this way, the Histadrut helped the Jewish working class substitute itself for a barely existent Jewish bourgeoisie in Mandate Palestine, meaning the period between when Britain promised Palestine to the Zionists and when the State of Israel was founded. So Jewish workers laid the foundation for Zionist capitalism by creating a Jewish-only union. This is very different than, say, whites-only unions in the south of the U.S., where white workers sided with the white racist ruling class because of false consciousness, and actually ended up with worse living standards than whites in regions with integrated unions. Jewish workers in Palestine actually needed an exclusively Jewish union and exclusively Jewish kibbutzim in order to get better living standards. Around 1930, David HaKohen, a leader of the Zionist Socialist Mapai, a precursor to today's Labor Party, wrote, quote, "I would not accept Arabs in my trade union, the Histadrut." He goes on to say, "To defend preaching to housewives that they not buy at Arab stores, to prevent Arab workers from getting jobs there, to pour kerosene on Arab tomatoes, to attack Jewish housewives in the market, and smash the Arab eggs they had bought, to praise to the skies the Karen Kayana," that's the Jewish National Fund, "that set Hankin to Beirut to buy land from absentee effendi or landowners, and to throw the fellahin, the peasant farmers, off the land, to buy dozens of dinars, it's a measure of land, from an Arab is permitted. But sell, God forbid, one Jewish dinar to an Arab is prohibited. So that's socialist Zionism, so-called. What uniquely characterized the Zionist project was the struggle to purchase land and occupy labor markets. The collectivist patterns and the exclusivist nature of Zionist colonization were a result of settling in a land that was relatively densely populated in comparison to, say, North America and Australia, where the preferred strategy was extermination of the indigenous populations. It's important to understand that Israel was not founded just by a group of idealistic kibbutzniks. In 1917, when Britain took control of Palestine from the Ottoman Empire, British Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour wrote a letter to Walter Rothschild, a leader of the Jewish community in the UK, declaring Palestine as a future homeland to the Jews. Without this imperial backing, Zionism would not have been able to transition from settlement in small numbers to the actual founding of a state in Israel. In the 1920s, there were only about 100,000 Jews living in Palestine. Certainly, anti-Semitism in Europe compelled a number of Jews to leave, but at that rate of emigration, Jews were not ever going to constitute any kind of majority. That is, until the Holocaust. And we need to talk about that, because you might ask the question, if the Jewish state was not necessary before the Holocaust, does the genocide of 6 million justify the need for a Jewish state? And one argument is that no other country would let in Jewish refugees, and this was for the most part true, with the notable exception of Sweden, which took in almost the entire community of Jewish community in Denmark. In 1939, the ship, the St. Louis, left Hamburg, Germany, with over 900 Jewish refugees, and they sailed to Cuba, but were refused disembarkation there. They proceeded to the U.S., they proceeded to Canada, and at every port they were turned away. Several refugees committed suicide by jumping ship, and eventually the refugees were sent back to Europe, where about a quarter died in concentration camps. The U.S. enacted the Quota Act, which limited the number of refugees allowed in, and even stifled news of the Final Solution in order to justify this restriction. British and American air forces refused to bomb the railway to Auschwitz, and only Palestinian Jews were welcoming the refugees from Europe. Even U.S. Zionists refused to help resettlement outside Palestine. We start here to see the problem. Why only Palestine? Why was there not a movement to allow Jews to safely emigrate to any country of their choosing? So here's the worry of David Ben-Gurion, who would later become the first prime minister of Israel. In December 17, 1938, he wrote a letter that said, quote, "If Jews will have to choose between the refugees, saving Jews from concentration camps, and assisting a national museum in Palestine, mercy will have the upper hand, and the whole energy of the people will be channeled into saving Jews from various countries, and Zionism will be struck off the agenda." So when faced with the choice of saving the Jews from Europe versus his colonial project, he's afraid that the people will choose saving the refugees. Even worse, Dr. Rudolf Kastner, the leader of the Hungarian Zionists, actually struck up an agreement with the Nazis in exchange for the emigration of a few thousand hand-picked Jews to Palestine, quote, "the best biological material," according to Eichmann. He promised to not let Jews know that the resettlement trains would be taking them to the gas chambers in Auschwitz. This is the proverbial deal with the devil. We see in these examples that the goal wasn't simply to save the Jews, but specifically to get them to Palestine, and then not only have them live there among the Arabs who were already present, but create a majority in order to justify a Jewish state. The Zionist argument: diaspora Jews need asylum, and this justifies all discrimination and dispossession against Palestinians. So if the Jewish question is how to protect Jews from anti-Semitism, we see that Zionism failed to solve the problem when anti-Semitism was at its peak. As Moshe Mapover, a member of the Israeli Socialist Organization, Max Penn, and socialist in the way that we would use the word, not in the way that socialist Zionists would use the word, this is how he put it, quote, "Zionism can only begin after you have given up on the struggle against anti-Semitism." So back to Palestine. During the mandate period, Zionists had used hiring discriminations and boycotts to exclude Arabs from the labor market. Once the State of Israel was founded, discrimination against Palestinians was codified into law. So the law of return grants every Jew the right to immigrate to Israel and reside there as a full citizen. This guarantees that Jews remain a majority and Arabs remain a minority. Within Israel proper, Jews and Palestinians, according to Zionists, are technically subject to the same laws, although there's huge exceptions to that. But in the occupied territories, they actually exist under completely different legal and administrative systems, one for Jews, one for non-Jews. Even within Israel proper, though, the law discriminates against Palestinians. While Jewish citizens are classified as having Jewish nationality, Israeli law methodically strips Palestinian citizens of their national identity and reduces them to an ethnic or religious affiliation, Muslim, Jew, Christian, Druze. Palestinians are not like immigrant ethnic minorities in that they're not interested in assimilating to the local culture. Their demand is beyond civil rights. They also need national rights as the indigenous people of the land. Beyond the issues of classification, Clause 7A to the Basic Law, which is the closest thing Israel has to a constitution, mandates that everyone who runs in elections must recognize Israel as the state of the Jewish people. So anyone who opposes, say, the law of return can't run for office. Beyond the legal restrictions, the very creation of the State of Israel came on massive displacement and violence. Here's a brief summary from Tikvah Honig-Parnas's excellent book, False Prophets of Peace. Quote, "The ethnic cleansing of Palestinians created a Jewish majority in the newly established state. Between 750,000 and 900,000 Palestinians, 55 to 66% of the total Palestinian population at that time were expelled or forced to leave their homeland between the end of 1947 and early 1949. 85% of the indigenous Palestinian population living in pre-state Israel was displaced. Furthermore, refugees were strictly prevented from returning to their villages and homes, even if they were only a short distance away. More than 500 Palestinian villages were destroyed, and 11 cities were depopulated. An additional 30,000 Palestinians remained inside the borders of the new Jewish state, and they either fled to nearby villages or were ordered to leave their villages for security reasons, with the promise that their departure would be temporary. Today, known as the internal refugees, they remain displaced. In 2008, their population had grown roughly to 250,000. The Zionist myth around what they call the War of Independence and what Palestinians call the Nakba, or disaster, was that the Jewish community was on the eve of destruction in 1948. Actually, the Israeli army outnumbered all Arab forces in Palestine during the war. The result of that war was a slight Jewish majority inside the Green Line and an Arab majority in Gaza and the West Bank. And this is just a brief summary of the violence involved in establishing Israel. A whole talk could be written on the atrocities committed by Israel during the Nakba. Now, even this situation was not good enough for Israel. In 1967, Israel launched a preemptive attack against Egypt, starting a war that drew in Jordan and Syria, and ending with Israel annexing the Golan Heights, the West Bank, Gaza, and the Sinai Peninsula. Here, Israel proved its potential as an ally to the U.S. by annihilating the Arab army. They proved that they could be relied on to neutralize hostile Arab regimes and to crush working people's movements that could tighten the U.S. control of the region and its resources. Now I'm going to turn it over to Sarah to take us into the modern era.
In the IDF, and they were women. We played games with water balloons that looked like grenades, and one summer we were even forced to watch a 4-hour documentary about the Holocaust. But to top it all off, there was an all-camp game that we played when I must have been 7 or 8 years old that was called Escape to Israel. The premise was that our cabin was a family with our counselors as our parents, and we were running around at night trying to get to different safe bases so that we could collect everyone's passport in order to make it to safety in Israel without getting kidnapped by other counselors who were hiding behind trees pretending to be the Gestapo.
We did that too.
So this is just one example of how Israel fosters the idea of anti-Semitism and a world unsafe for Jews almost subconsciously into young children who it hopes will grow up to be Zionists. In the second half of this talk, I will argue that while empire plays a role as the main political and economic factor of Israel, as 78 began to lay out, the notion of anti-Semitism functions as the psychological and emotional reinforcement by providing a justification for Israel's colonial project today. Given the popular myth of Israel as the Messiah of the Jews and the solution to anti-Semitism, in the following I will try to answer the questions: what is really the state of anti-Semitism today? What should socialists say about anti-Semitism? And if Zionism isn't a solution to anti-Semitism, what would be a better alternative? I will argue that Zionism, by deliberately conflating Jews with Israel and anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, actually makes the world less safe for Jews, who, according to Zionism's logic, become implicated in Israel's crimes and thus targets of anti-Israel sentiment. I'm not going to go in detail through the incredible racism that pervades Israeli society, but I do think that a good question to grapple with is what factors can lead to a society where it's socially acceptable to lynch Palestinians in the middle of downtown and where graffiti-reading ghastly Arabs can be left up for months. I think that one way that you can get to such extreme levels of hate is through intense fear-mongering. In the case of Israel, the threat of Jewish ethnic annihilation is made out to be a common-sense foundation for how to understand the world and your place in it as a Jew or as an Israeli, and this "the world is out to get us" mentality is promoted in schools, the media, politics, and even Jewish summer camps in Portland, Oregon. In Max Blumenfeld's book, Goliath, he describes how in Israel, the fear-mongering also starts at a young age. Blumenfeld talks about walking into a primary school classroom where the teacher has written on the board, "Who wants to kill us?" The answers being Pharaoh, Nazis, and Arabs. And then the subsequent question, "What do we need?" The answer being a state. As Daniel Bartal, professor of political psychology at Tel Aviv University, told Blumenfeld, "How do you get kids to go to the checkpoints? How do you get kids to go to Gaza? You have to form a particular framework or prism of thought. You begin with a Zionist narrative, and it goes on and on and on through the holidays, national ceremonies, through the media, and then through the army with intense indoctrination." He continues, "Think about an American kid who is taught at a very young age that America is great, and then add to this the context where the Israeli kids live, that they have to serve in the army, and you can see why they need so much preparation, legitimization, and justification for the acts they have to participate in." In general, the fear of this second Holocaust is used to justify Israel's worst crimes against the Palestinians. Another way, though, that this fear is reinforced today is by a chorus of voices shouting about the new anti-Semitic menace in the media. So since the early 2000s, there's been a spate of articles and books on the topic, such as "The Globalization of Anti-Semitism," "The Return of Anti-Semitism," "The New Anti-Semitism," "The Case for Israel," and "Never Again?" And so in Never Again, Abraham Foxman, the national director of the Anti-Defamation League, writes, "I am convinced that we currently face as great a threat to the safety and security of the Jewish people as the one we faced in the 1930s, if not a greater one." And writing in New York Magazine, Craig Horowitz adds, "It is once again acceptable in polite society, particularly among people with left-of-center political views, to freely express anti-Jewish feelings. What only 2 or 3 years ago would have been considered hateful, naked bigotry is now a legitimate political position." Horowitz, like many of the other authors, explains that the new in the new anti-Semitism can be summed up as, in a word, anti-Zionism. And he explains that while he and the rest of these writers are not against criticism of Israel entirely, that criticism should be part of any democracy, the level of intensity, they say, of the anti-Israel calling out should be understood as no more than anti-Jew hatred. As Foxen writes, "The harsh but undeniable truth is that what some like to call anti-Zionism is, in reality, anti-Semitism, always, everywhere, and for all time. Therefore, anti-Zionism is not a politically legitimate point of view, but rather an expression of bigotry and hatred." And now, anti-Semitism is not something that we should take lightly, and so if this new anti-Semitism really is as big a threat as they're making it out to be, we should be aware. But let's look at what these authors are really describing when they use the label anti-Semitism. For example, the U.S.-based Simon Wiesenthal Center, which describes itself as a global human rights organization that works to confront anti-Semitism, hate, and terrorism, and to defend the safety of Jews worldwide, put out a list of the 10 worst global anti-Semitic incidents of 2014. And on this list, it included, side by side, the brutal assault on a Jewish couple, including the rape of a woman in an apartment in the outskirts of Paris, 2 obscure anti-Israel extremists, Max Blumenthal and David Sheen, being invited to speak in Germany, the United Auto Workers Union Local number 2865, which represents graduate students in California voting to support BDS, and a former KKK member who drove into a Jewish home for the aging in suburban Kansas and shot three people, after which he told a journalist that he, quote, wanted to make damn sure I killed some Jews before I died. And so, unfortunately, this list is pretty representative of most descriptions of the new anti-Semitism. So while some of it is real anti-Semitism, like the last example, much of it is actually anti-Zionism. Yet by listing them all together as examples of the new threat, they're made out to be the same, both examples of anti-Jew hate and actions. And Obama even recently echoed this conflation of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism when he was asked by The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg about the differences between the two, and he responded saying, quote, "You know, I think a good baseline is, do you think that Israel has a right to exist as a homeland for the Jewish people? And are you aware of the particular circumstances of Jewish history that might prompt that need and desire? And if your answer is no, if you think that history doesn't matter, then that's a problem in my mind. If, on the other hand, you acknowledge the active presence of anti-Semitism, if you acknowledge that there are people and nations that, if convenient, would do to the Jewish people harm because of a warped ideology, then you should align yourself with Israel when its security is at stake." And so Obama, just a second. So according to Obama, to say that Israel shouldn't exist as a Jewish state is necessarily anti-Semitic. And this idea might be worth going more into in discussion. But in short, this argument is based on the notion that, like other oppressed nations, Jews deserve the right to self-determination, and thus to deny them Israel is inherently anti-Semitic. Now, there are several problems with this argument, but to me the most important issue is simply that one nation's self-determination cannot be contrary to another nation's national rights. And not only was this Jewish state not designed with the safety of the Jews in mind, as Stephanie laid out, but in practice, Israel means so-called democracy for the Jews and incredible human rights abuses for everyone else. Basic rights are denied not only to Palestinians, but also to African refugees and asylum seekers, as well as foreign workers, based on no more than their ethnicity, because the simple fact that they are not Jewish makes them an existential threat to the Jewish state. And for perspective, we supported the Irish independence and the self-determination of the Irish, but we wouldn't have supported the Irish colonizing Scotland or Greenland in order to achieve the self-determination. And overall, there's a difference between denying the right of Israel as a supposedly Jewish state to exist, and denying Jews the right to exist. Calling for an end to Israel does not mean calling for death to the Jews, but simply for an end to a colonial regime, a demand which today actually a growing number of Jews are coming to support. Going back though, like I said, there are two different phenomena being labeled as anti-Semitism. We have attacks on Jews and Jewish institutions, and critique of Israel and other boycott, divestment, sanctions, or BDS-related activities. And now, most of the time, especially here in the U.S., when we hear claims of anti-Semitism, it's of the second variety. As anyone who's been involved with BDS knows, this is one of the main ways that supporters of Israel try to shut down debate and to delegitimize our side. So a recent report from the Center for Constitutional Rights titled "Accusations of Anti-Semitism Used to Deter Advocacy for Palestinian Rights" found that in just the first 4 months of 2015, in addition to dozens of cases of censorship and even death threats to Arab and Muslim student activists, the Palestine Solidarity Legal Support Group responded to 60 incidents involving accusations of anti-Semitism made against faculty, and 24 incidents involving accusations of support for terrorism made against students only based on speech critical of Israeli policy. Okay, but if most of these cries of anti-Semitism are really regarding anti-Zionism, does this mean simply that there's no anti-Semitism? And this is what some leftists have said, in response to the false claims of anti-Semitism. For example, in an article published on Counterpunch, Michael Newman, the author of the book The Case Against Israel, writes, "I think we should almost never take anti-Semitism seriously, and maybe we should even have some fun with it." Newman flippantly admits to the existence of some forms of anti-Semitism, such as the distributions of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and myths about Jews stealing the blood of Gentile babies, saying, "This is utterly inexcusable. So is your failure to answer Aunt B's last letter." And Newman ends up concluding that since anti-Zionism is a moral obligation, and if anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, then anti-Semitism is a moral obligation. As Sebastia writes in ISR number 38, this upside-down logic doesn't challenge the basic framework that Israel's defenders use. It just stakes out an anti-Zionist stance within their framework, which ends up concluding that anti-Semitism is non-existent at best and justifiable at worst. Now, the problem with Newman's argument is that even though some, and probably even the majority of what Israel labels as anti-Semitism is in actuality anti-Zionism, there has actually been a rise in attacks against Jews, or the real anti-Semitism, in the last decade. So what is the status of real anti-Semitism? To clarify, it's hard to know exact figures of anti-Semitic incidents because many are misnamed as such, as described above. But even given this, it does seem that there has been a it does seem that anti-Semitic incidents have been rising over the last several years. So according to researchers at Tel Aviv University, the number of violent anti-Semitic attacks around the world surged nearly 40% in 2014, with incidents ranging from the desecration of Jewish cemeteries, to graffiti on Jewish homes, to attacks on Jewish school children, to assaults on Jews entering or leaving synagogues, and even to violent assaults. And the Pew Research Center found that as of 2013, Jews were harassed in 34 of 45 European countries. In France, which is home to Europe's largest Jewish community, during just 1 week last July, which notably was in the midst of Israel's attack on Gaza that killed over 2,000 people, 8 synagogues were attacked, a kosher supermarket and pharmacy was trashed and looted, and mobs were seen yelling, "Death to the Jews." But while looking at these examples of real anti-Semitism, it's important to not just view them in isolation, as the media so want to do. This is because while the new anti-Semitism has been all over the news, a similar rise in anti-Muslim and anti-Arab hate crimes has received hardly any attention. In just a quick survey, in less than a week after the Charlie Hebdo massacre, 26 mosques around France were attacked by firebombs, gunfire, pig heads, and grenades. In Canada, according to the National Council of Canadian Muslims, the week after Hebdo brought a 10-fold increase in harassment against Muslims. And in the US, since 9/11, there have been between 5 and 10 times more anti-Arab and anti-Muslim attacks as before 2001. So if anything, this should all show us that attacks on Jews are both not an isolated thing, but also that the very people who are so concerned about anti-Jew attacks have nothing to say against these anti-Muslim attacks. Okay, but if anti-Semitism is a thing, then why, and where does it come from? As socialists and as proponents against Zionism, who see Zionism as not being the answer to anti-Semitism, I think we have to have something to say about this rising trend and these incidents. This is where it's especially important to be Marxists or materialists and ask what factors are leading to the new rise in anti-Semitism, rather than view it as something eternal, as the Zionists would like us to believe. So today, unlike the 1930s, when anti-Semitism was promoted by country leaders, most of those committing anti-Semitic acts mainly fall into two bottom-up groups, and these are the far-right wing and Muslim youth. And so the European Monitoring Center on Racism and Xenophobia issued a report noting that the majority of those behind the anti-Semitic assaults in some countries are right-wing skinheads or neo-Nazis. The center concluded that overall, the majority of perpetrators of anti-Semitic acts are white Europeans, many of whom are also attacking Muslims and Arabs. And here, note how in the racist manifesto of the Charleston shooter, Dylan Roof, right after his section on the blacks, he had a section on the Jews, followed by a section on the Hispanics. And so, although Roof is, of course, from the U.S., this far-right Jewish hate should be understood more as part of the rise of fascism in Europe that relates to the politics of austerity, and both in Europe and the U.S., but stronger in Europe, than as a separate rise of anti-Semitism. However, the Monitoring Center also concluded that in other countries, an increasing number of the anti-Semitic attacks are carried out by Muslim youth. And regarding the second group, we should ask, how much of the resurgent anti-Semitism is the result of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians? And evidence suggests that most of the perpetrators of anti-Jewish attacks in France were animated by political outrage, not bigotry. Even according to the Israeli Foreign Ministry, many of the incidents of anti-Semitism that it looked at all around the world were understood as protests against inequities in the occupied territories, with the attack on Gaza last summer being a significant influence. For example, you had France where worshippers in a synagogue were surrounded by a howling mob claiming to protest Israeli policy, and in Germany, where a synagogue was petrol-bombed, supposedly in solidarity with the Palestinian cause. And as Brian Clug wrote in The Nation, in the Arab and Muslim world today, unlike in Europe in the 20th century, the political conflict is what comes first and goes deep, while anti-Semitism is a secondary formation, a byproduct of aspirations and grievances that have nothing to do with a priori prejudice against Jews, but more to do with the current crisis that began in 2000 with the breakdown of the Oslo Peace Initiative and the outbreak of the Second Intifada. In an article for Jacobin, Richard Seymour explores this idea in depth, looking at the political factors in France that contribute to young Arabs and Muslims turning to Islamic fundamentalism as an expression of Palestinian solidarity. While it's too much to go into here, Seymour argues that it has more to do with the failure of the left in France to take up Arab and Muslim struggles, such as the banning of the hijab, which has led some Muslims to seek a solution in another political current, fundamentalist Islam, which explains the conflict in religious terms and hence proposes attacks against Jews as a strategy. And of course, this isn't by any means the majority of Muslim or Arab youth. It's just a fraction, but so it's something we should understand. And so even as we condemn these attacks, I think we can't simply blame the attackers. Rather, we should understand their conflation of Jews and Israel as the logical outcome of Israeli and U.S. Policy and rhetoric that is precisely aimed to conflate the two in order to justify Israel's existence. This is because if Israel weren't marketed as necessary for the Jews the world over to be safe, it would be a lot harder for the international community to swallow its policies of racism, apartheid, colonization, and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. The conflation of all Jews with Israel can be seen in how Israel does not regard itself as a state that just happens to be Jewish, but sees itself as, in Prime Minister Sharon's phrase, the Jewish collective, or the sovereign state of the Jewish people as a whole. And besides such rhetoric, on the ground in Palestine, Israel actually also does a lot to conflate the state with the Jews as well. There's the Star of David on the flag, graffiti done by soldiers and settlers in homes that have been taken over, shops that have been forced closed on Shuhada Street, and even homes that have been bombed and raided in Gaza have been marked with the Star of David. What am I on time? Imagine if crosses were painted on homes destroyed by the American military in Afghanistan. It would create a sense of holy war, putting Christians across the world in more danger as the mark of Christianity was stamped on all of America's war crimes and terrorization. And as Jonathan Cook, an anti-Zionist journalist living in Nazareth, writes, this does not justify for one moment a single incident where Jews are attacked for being Jewish, but it does provide a context within which to make sense of them without seeing a global war against the Jews. Jews have good reason to be concerned about growing hostility toward them, but while this at times includes the revival of hardcore anti-Semitism, it is closer to the truth to say that anti-Zionism today takes the form of anti-Semitism rather than the other way around, as people like Foxman would like us to believe. In other words, when Israel puts so much effort into saying that Israel represents all Jews, it's no wonder that, lacking a Marxist understanding of Zionism, legitimate anti-Israel sentiment can be taken out on Jews. And this is what Richard Seymour refers to as the anti-Zionism of fools. To counter this, we need to work to separate Judaism from Israel, while also fighting against both Zionist policies and against all manifestations of real anti-Semitism. And this is why it's important to go through the history. The Jewish state isn't and has never been a safe place for Jews, but is an outpost of empire and an active colonial state with aims to ethnically cleanse the native population. We need to be clear that what Israel is doing is not Jewish, it's racist and colonialist, and opposing such a state does not equate to anti-Semitism. To conclude, this brings up the question, if Zionism isn't the savior of the Jews, or perhaps more appropriately, even an answer to anti-Semitism, what would be a better alternative? In 1920, Winston Churchill wrote an essay titled Zionism or Bolshevism, The Struggle for the Soul of the Jewish People, in which he outlined Zionism as a force that could get Jews to stop joining these pesky socialist organizations around them, something which he saw as a threat to the world order. So what could possibly have been their attraction? As socialists and generally as anti-racists, we're against anti-Semitism, but we're also for ridding the world of racism of all sorts. On the contrary, while Zionism presents itself as a solution to anti-Semitism, it only cares about the Jews, and arguably, if that, but not about other oppressions. Racism against any other group is irrelevant. Furthermore, rather than wanting to see anti-Semitism in the dustbin of history, for Israel, anti-Semitism is actually critical to Zionism's existence because it reaffirms the necessity of Israel as a Jewish Zionist state. So while Zionism is happy to cooperate with empire for the good of the Jewish state, we as socialists see the connection between empire and racism and the need to connect the struggles against both in order to win a better world for all. Luckily for us, though, there's a rich history of both Jews and others struggling against racism and anti-Semitism in their own countries and against the lure of Zionism. In his book, Zionism, False Messiah, Nathan Weinstock documents how the Bolsheviks put the struggle against anti-Semitism at the front of their program, creating and supporting Yiddish schools and newspapers while working to build Jewish cadre and specific Jewish workers' organizations. Jews were disproportionately represented in the socialist parties in Russia and Europe at the height of those movements because socialists put the fight against oppression as the central component to a revolutionary struggle against capitalism. Ultimately, the real fight against anti-Semitism has to be linked to the fight against all oppression. For that reason, anti-Zionism and the fight against Palestinian oppression have much more in common with the struggle against anti-Semitism than Zionism does. And this is why, to Churchill's question of Zionism or Bolshevism, the answer should be clear. It's Bolshevism.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.